Well, thank you so much for being with me today on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. Adrian Elrod, you're my 67th guest. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Congratulations on all of your success, and I'm very happy to be on with you today.
Thank you. You're the former senior advisor and spokeswoman for Biden for president, mm-hmm. and Harris for president, former director Indeed. Of external and government affairs at the CHIPS program office at the U.S. Department of Commerce, former chief of staff for former U.S. House of Representatives Loretta Sanchez. When you think of relationship building in a team environment, Adrian, what does it mean to you and what has it meant for your professional career?
Yeah, look, I think when you go unilaterally at something, meaning that if you're trying to tackle a challenge or a problem or, even some sort of new project that you want to take on, you cannot do it unilaterally. It doesn't work. Donald Trump always saying, I alone can fix it. Well, that's not the case. We all know that. It takes a village. It takes a team. The way that I've always appreciated being managed and the way that I like to manage a team is to be collaborative, to make it very clear whether you're the intern who is on a 6-week internship or whether you're the legislative director or whether you are, the campaign manager of a big presidential campaign. Everybody's opinion matters. I think it's incredibly important to sort of run a collaborative environment. That's the way that when I was sort of moving up in this world, I always liked to be managed. And that is certainly the way that I run a team. So I think collaboration is key and very important to whatever your challenge is that you're trying to tackle.
Of course, in your career, I believe, started back in the Clinton years. You worked in the Clinton White House and...
Aging myself. But yes, indeed.
Trying not to age yourself or just... You rose the political ranks and in the Democratic Party, and other guests I'll have on my podcast, Sheila Nix, Ron mm-hmm. Klain,
Jay Love Carney. Sheila.
Yes, Ron Klain, Jay Carney are looking to be scheduled on my podcast. I've had Arshi Siddiqui, who is a former senior policy advisor and counsel for former Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. I've had Chuck Todd on, mm-hmm. and Elizabeth Alexander might be coming on the pod later this year.
Good.
All of these people that you have come to work with, just building these relationships with all the big players in the Democratic Party, what have those relationships meant to you? And, what were some of those pivotal moments in your career where you felt like, wow, this is relationship building at its finest?
Well, look, Washington, D.C. certainly works on relationship building. When you hear the term, it's who you know, it really is the case. It doesn't mean that somebody who doesn't have connections in Washington, D.C. can't get started working on campaigns, working on Capitol Hill, working in politics. But it certainly does help to have relationships. Case in point, I always tell young people who want to get involved on a campaign or want to start a job in government that, if you don't have contacts, reach out to somebody from your alumni, go to LinkedIn and do a search. In fact, I just got reached out to today by a young woman who just graduated from TCU, my alma mater, via LinkedIn. And I reached back out and said, I'm so happy to have a conversation with you. But, assuming that she and I talk and I connect her with a few other folks and she eventually lands a job, then you're in, then you're set. And then you can build your own relationships to help you network and take it to the next level and so on and so forth. But, when I moved to Washington, D.C., Garrett, in 1998, I knew 3 people. And 2 of them were my aunt and uncle who lived in Falls Church, Virginia. I did not have a deep network, but I hustled. And every single person who was willing to have coffee with me, I asked them if they would connect me to 2 to 3 other people. And sooner rather than later, you built your own network. And that's the network that still to this day really carries me forward. A lot of the people that I worked with in the White House in 1998, 1999, I still work on campaigns with. I still go to dinner with. I call on them for favors or, I ask them quite often, do you know this person or do you know somebody in this state or do you know somebody at this agency? Do you know somebody at this organization? And they do the same thing to me. So networking is incredibly important. Relationship building is the foundation of that network. And that's the network that, again, carries you kind of through your career in whatever, I think, industry that you decide to work in.
Yes, and you worked for the Clinton administration. You also...
I worked for Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008 during the primary. And then I went on to Capitol Hill and worked as Loretta Sanchez's chief of staff for about 5.5 years. And then I went to a political organization before I joined Hillary Clinton's campaign in 15 and 16.
And what were those experiences like working for former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
I mean, she's just the best. I can't say enough great things about her. She's been a longtime mentor to me. She's certainly the smartest person in the room, but talk about somebody who is collaborative. I really learned the spirit of, you know, bringing people together, taking an assessment of everyone's ideas in the room to really come up with your final conclusion. That's the way she operates. I did not work for her when she was Secretary of State, but she was very much known for her collaborative approach on all major policy issues. And again, she's somebody who, it doesn't matter if you're the person who is writing press releases, or if you are the person that is talking to the press, or if you're the person who is driving policy in a certain domestic policy area, she wants everyone's opinion. And she's been a longtime mentor to me. That I will say that both 2008 and 2016 campaigns were very heartbreaking. Of course, in 2008, we infamously lost to Barack Obama, who's not the worst person in the world to lose to. And she went on to be an incredible Secretary of State. And he, of course, went on to be a great president. But I really was hoping that 2016 would be the time that we actually made it happen for Hillary. And of course, history speaks for itself. No need to rehash what the finality was of that 2016 election. But I will say that, you know, not that I'm focusing on the past, but the one thing I will say is America really lost out and the world lost out by not having Hillary Clinton president. Her impact continues to remain, you know, very significant on both domestic policy and global policy in this world. And I think she will go down as one of the most historical figures, not just here in the United States, but globally of our lifetimes, or perhaps since the world has existed. She is someone who I deeply look up to and who I admire and respect very much. And it was truly the honor of a lifetime to work for her.
And how would you compare her to Vice President Harris, former Vice President Harris? I mean, the only two women to have reached the pinnacle in terms of being a serious presidential candidate or literally on the ticket. And I know, and we all know, that unfortunately Hillary Clinton fell short and so did Vice President Harris. But if you could look at these two women and say, what were the qualities or characteristics, the attributes that both share, or and where were they somewhat different that, you know, made them shine and made them on the national stage to get as far as they did, one being, again, a former First Lady and then Secretary of State, former U.S. Senator, Kamala Harris being former senator herself and then being Vice President. So I just was curious your thoughts.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, first of all, you don't get to be Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris if you're not incredibly smart and collaborative and know how to be, you know, an effective communicator and politician. I hate the term politician, but it is true in this sense. I mean, you don't get to reach the level that they've reached if you're not good at what you do. I will say that they are both incredibly smart. I mean, just being in a room at the table with either Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris is a real opportunity because they're both incredibly smart. They have a very, they have different approaches, I think. Everybody has different styles to approaching policy, and they have different issues that have really sort of become their pet issues, for lack of a better term. You know, Hillary Clinton, healthcare has always been the issue that she's championed, you know, back when she, you know, right when she graduated from college, she went to work for the Children's Defense Fund and she championed healthcare as First Lady of Arkansas, really took on quality and affordable healthcare when she was First Lady of the United States. And of course, so on and so forth. Vice President Harris has really taken criminal justice reform as sort of her major issue, you know, obviously being a former DA, former prosecutor, you know, being the attorney general. So they're both very accomplished attorneys, but they've taken different issues as sort of their pet issue. But the bottom line is this, you know, they're both incredibly strong, effective women. And I think we are still facing a challenge in this country in terms of how to process and approach a woman running for president. I'm certainly hoping that I will see one in my lifetime. I think that I will. And we certainly have a number of really incredibly effective female senators and governors, you know, members of Congress, mayors, you name it. But there's something about that highest office in the land that still seems to be a persistent challenge to the American people in terms of trying to decide what kind of person they want, what kind of woman they're, you know, female they're looking for. And I certainly, you know, I don't want to go too far into the election and why we came up short this time around. But I still think that sexism plays a substantial role in presidential elections. And I hope that we can continue to work hard to overcome some of those built-in stereotypes that a lot of people have in this country.
And do you feel like just from the opposition standpoint and the campaign that the Trump team ran, and with the influence of Elon Musk and that persistence of, you know, social media outreach, and not being able to, for the average everyday American voter, not being able to fact check the things that they were learning about or reading about, you know, coming from the Trump team. And it really, to your point, unfortunately, tragically, the sexism component and her, you know, being a woman from the state of California and San Francisco, and that label of a California liberal and a woman, which I think is totally unfair. And really in 2025, there's no place in politics for, you know, casting any aspersions on somebody based upon race or gender.
Absolutely. We're way past that. At least I thought we were way past that. It turns out we're not way past that. You know, look, that's a loaded question, and I don't have enough time today to get into all the tactics the Trump team used, misinformation, disinformation. There were certainly shortcomings on our end, not necessarily. I mean, Kamala was incredible, and she rose to the occasion and exceeded all expectations, no matter the challenge. She had 170 days to try to win the presidency, and every single day she fought as hard as possible, and she was virtually error-free, which is really hard to say when you're running for office, to not have a lot of mistakes that you can point to, and she didn't. She really ran a truly stellar effort on her part to become president, and I think we ran a really solid, strong campaign, but there were some shortcomings along the way. You know, it's not just Trump, it's the whole MAGA movement, Steve Bannon, Charlie Kirk, you name it. They've been working on this, building out this infrastructure to, you know, use influencers who may not necessarily be quote unquote political people, but, you know, are into monster trucks or are into knitting or are into fashion or whatever it may be, that have their own platforms. And they were really able to effectively build, you know, an ecosystem that allowed them to communicate their message about Trump and what they want out of America through those platforms, through those channels, which is how they were able to engage, you know, voters who don't typically turn out for elections, or, you know, I think we call them disengaged voters, who this time around was primarily young men between the ages of 18 and 25, who either had not voted before or sat out the 2020 election. They were turning out in droves for Trump. I mean, you saw black MAGA hats were like the cool thing on a lot of college campuses across this country. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were getting communicated to and by through a network that was not MSNBC, CNN, even Fox News. It was different channels, different podcasts, different YouTube shows, different, you know, a variety of different platforms, gaming platforms. And that is something that we as Democrats, if we're going to actually combat the disinformation and misinformation war, we have to meet voters where they are. You know, I do a lot of cable news. I do a lot of MSNBC in particular. And a lot of these people are not, in fact, most of them are not watching MSNBC. And when you go on MSNBC, you're essentially communicating to an audience that is with you, that is voting with you, and you're kind of making them feel better. So I think the Trump campaign, let me be clear, they won this election fair and square. It was not a mandate of a win, but it was a decisive win. But if Democrats are going to effectively be able to take on the MAGA movement or whatever movement comes next and win back the election in 2028, a lot of the groundwork in terms of infrastructure, combating misinfo and disinfo needs to take place right now.
And, you know, there's a lot there to uncover. And I really appreciate you saying all this. I mean, you know, I got my start in D.C. on the Hill. I was a former intern for a U.S. congressman from North Carolina, 13th district before gerrymandering took effect. But Brad Miller, a fellow UNC Chapel Hill Tar Heel like me, I worked at NBC Universal. That's how I got to know Chuck Todd. And then we got reconnected on my podcast. And I also went to Georgetown University and I did an internship for the CBS affiliate WSA9. So I very much got exposed to D.C. early on. I've kept my relationship since. And that's why I really enjoy talking to you, someone who's totally a part of the fabric of D.C. And I've been admiring, you know, the presidential candidates on the Democratic side for a long time. And, you know, obviously there are some networks who say that they're fair and balanced. I'm not going to name which particular network or the particular network that is, but I've been interviewed as well on cable network television, whether it's left, middle, right. And, you know, I find that the audiences are particularly tuned into the ideologies and the belief systems that they're going to identify with, especially come voting time. And I just think that going back to the election with President Biden, I mean, he won an historic election in 2020. Biden won very decisively by 7 million votes. He had to right the wrongs of the Trump administration because there was a mismanagement of the COVID-19 pandemic. And I just felt that President Biden and the Democratic Party were on their heels from the very beginning because the Republicans wanted to say that President Biden was an illegitimate president, that the election was stolen. And we all know how that played out. And I think that if there's one fair criticism I can say about the Biden team, nothing about policy. They passed extraordinary policy. President Biden, in my opinion, was a great president, one of the most consequential, successful presidents to pass legislation since LBJ and even before that FDR. But when you don't have the right communication apparatus around you, not from an intellectual standpoint, not from a competency standpoint, just from a frequency standpoint, I know that Governor Newsom has talked about it in past that maybe the communication team could have been better to get the message out there, to get it amplified, because President Biden, you know, him and his team were working, they were passing great policy, they were getting a lot done, but people at home weren't understanding, okay, why is inflation up? You know, not understanding that there was extra stimulus having to go into the economy to get people, you know, moving again, getting businesses started back up from the pandemic. And I just think that, you know, Biden was able to, when he left office, get inflation down to 2.9% from 9.1%. So
especially when you compare that, by the way, to other industrialized countries. I mean, the United States was doing it. Inflation was high, but it was high globally. And it was high globally because of the pandemic, supply chain disruptions, you name it, all the things that come with a once in a generation global pandemic. And President Biden's policies, to your point, that he put in place and fought very hard to put in place, mostly with Democratic support, no Republican support, really helped mitigate some of the inflationary challenges that we had. But look, here's the bottom line. Anytime inflation is high, it is very hard for the incumbent president who is leading the White House when inflation is high to get reelected. That's just the bottom line. There's a thing that they call the economy stupid. Right. That's something that, of course, James Carville coined with President Clinton during his reelection in 1996. It's true. If the economy is going well and people are feeling good, then generally the incumbent running for reelection will win. If people are not feeling great economically, then that person tends to lose. And I think, you know, President Biden passed historic legislation. There's so much to be grateful for and so much to be proud of. And I think history will show that he will go down as an FDR-like president when it comes to the policies that he was able to put in place. However, I think there are some things that we, as somebody who is one of his top spokespeople, that we could have done a little bit better. And number one, I think you cannot say when somebody says, I'm feeling the challenges of the economy. Prices are too high. You know, I can't get, you know, a mortgage that I can afford because interest rates are too high. All these things. I'm not, you know, I'm applying for jobs, but I'm not getting the type of interviews that I want. Or I'm not, you know, yes, I know that unemployment's low, but I can't, you know, I'm not getting jobs that I actually want. You can't go out there and say to them, oh, actually, you're wrong. The economy is actually doing great and unemployment is low and wages are high and, you know, so on and so forth. Prices are actually going down when people aren't feeling that. And I think I am actually not blaming President Biden on this at all, because I think he was really good about going out there and saying, I still have a lot of work to do on this, but it's just difficult to try to communicate statistics that show that the economy is doing well when in fact a lot of people are not feeling it. And I think that that's something that we could have done a little bit more effectively on the campaign.
Could you have looked at it from a, you know, educative standpoint? Because, you know, to educate, again, when I say average everyday Americans, I don't mean average intellectually, because you can have highly intellectual people who may not be, you know, politically savvy or their informed citizenry in our country. But maybe, again, they're not thinking about the bread and butter issues unless it's personally affecting them. I think that, again, this could be, you know, a longer conversation, and I find this very fascinating speaking with you. But I think that if you peel the layers back and look back when Biden started, I mean, first president in 100 years to have to deal with a once in a 100-year pandemic. You mentioned the supply chain disruption issues. You think about Trump's last year in office when he was, you know, sending out stimulus checks, or his administration rather, that nearly it was not enough. And if you artificially drop interest rates, and then when Biden is in office and then you raise interest rates back up and you're trying to follow the Fed chair's advice, you know, Fed chair Jerome Powell, and he's trying to deliberately, you know, systematically get interest rates where they should be, but he's not really thinking about the political news cycle. He's not thinking about the election cycle or even midterms. And Republicans did not come out. The red wave never happened in 2022. So it is interesting to me, whether you think about like a Ron DeSantis who may have missed his mark. He probably, if he ran a more effective campaign, he probably could have been president. But it is interesting that from a Republican standpoint, they were willing to move on from Trump. And then really in less than, 24 months, it was back to him being the leader of the party. So there weren't any fresh ideas, new ideas. They just thought that, okay, he'll come back in and he'll fix everything. But they forgot that it was artificially a stimulated economy, I believe, under Trump, because you had a $2 trillion tax cut. And people realized that he wasn't really thinking about, or he wasn't being as transparent about COVID, unless you listen to the Bob Woodward tapes. You know, he wasn't transparent to the American people about COVID. So then you go into Biden's term. And really, as I mentioned earlier, you're on your heels, having to deal with the narrative that Biden's an illegitimate president, the election was rigged, it was stolen. And you never saw in history, even going back to the Bush years or the George H.W. Bush years, the Reagan years, you never really had any party, whether Democrats or Republicans, having to worry about, yes, obviously politicians try to gain ground and they try to put out their fair share of narratives, but nothing to the effect of misinformation, disinformation, where you really, you know, your backs were against the wall. And yet, I really appreciate you sharing with my audience that as one of the spokeswomen for the Biden campaign and Biden reelection, that communication could have been better. But I really feel that when Kamala gains, over 75 million votes, you still had, Jill Stein, you still had RFK Jr., sharing a half a point each of those votes. And like Hillary in 2016, she had to face Jill Stein. Like Kamala Harris in 2024, Jill Stein wasn't a part of the 2020 election. So I kind of feel like there's the women vote, taking something away from, Kamala, or taking something away from Hillary. So I just find it all fascinating. Adrian.
No, absolutely. And I think this time around, we certainly thought that the third party challenge, RFK Jr., for example, was going to be more of an issue to contend with than it actually was. And it ended up, still for the most part being a two candidate race. But, as Americans continue to be really frustrated with both parties, I mean, if you look at the popularity of both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the approvals are relatively low for both. I do think, and I am a proud Democrat and will continue to be a proud Democrat, and I will only work for Democrats, but I do believe that if there's a time and a place for a really effective third party challenge, somebody who, is a true center candidate, whether that's center left or center right, but somebody who's truly in the center, sort of like the DLC, Democratic Leadership Council, centrist approach that was quite popular under President Clinton's tenure back in the 90s. I think this is the time where that candidate or series of candidates could emerge, because again, people are really frustrated with both parties, and the way the infrastructure is built in both the Democratic and the Republican Party, it is hard because of the electoral vote process and the primary process to emerge as an independent candidate, in an effective way. I mean, you look back at Ross Perot in 1992, I mean, he got 20% of the vote, but he essentially, poured a ton of money, of his own money, into the race. So it's certainly not an easy thing to do, and you've got to qualify for the ballot in a lot of these states. And that's also no small task. That's a difficult task. But at the end of the day, with social media and people getting information, from a number of different platforms that didn't even exist, 10 years ago, even. I do think that we are ripe for an environment where an independent third party candidate could be effective this time around.
And did you like the fact that from whether it was Bernie Sanders to Liz Cheney, the broad coalition that even Van Jones talked about on CNN, he and a lot of Democrats, and I wonder if you share that opinion, that it was healthy to see that you can have the furthest left, like a Bernie Sanders, or AOC, but to have someone like a Liz Cheney, and even the support of her father, Dick Cheney, our former vice president, that you have that broad coalition, you say, wow, maybe for 2028, we'll continue to see that broad coalition. And is that the direction the party wants to go? Or is it not helpful in your estimation to have those blurred lines, and maybe, there should just be right for Republican, left for Democrat, and then if that there is that independent party to emerge one day, that they're its own party? Or do you like that broad coalition?
I mean, I certainly appreciate a broad coalition because I'm a Democrat, and I think we've always been a big tent party. We've got progressives in our party, we've got moderates in our party, we've got everything in between. And, to the point that you made about the Liz Cheneys of this world and some of the quote unquote, never Trump Republicans. They were a part of our coalition in 2016, even more so in 2020 and also in 2024. So I think it's incredibly important that Democrats keep that coalition together. But if we're going to win back the presidency, we've got to grow the coalition.
Of course. And I think that, again, to your point, a big tent party, very important for the Democrats. And I think the point I was also trying to make is the fact that were you a little bit surprised that you couldn't get more of those Trump voters for 2024 and that a lot of Biden's and Harris's supports from 2020 moved over to Trump? So is that more of a communications issue to what we talked about earlier? Just again, how does the economy affect you? The policies are great. You're passing, you're having a productive, you know, Congress, you're working, executive and legislative branches are working together, but at the same time, not feeling those wins. And I think that maybe that answers the question of not being able to get more support in 2024.
Yeah, look, I think a lot of the, we call them sporadic voters, voters who turn out sometimes in presidential elections, but not necessarily in the midterm elections. Again, going back to what we said earlier, that group of voters who turned out this election cycle more so than we realized that they would, and I think probably more so than the Trump team realized they would, were young men. You know, young men who were inspired by Elon Musk and thought he was cool and edgy and wanted to kind of be like him, or people who thought that the Biden's policies on crypto were a little too aggressive and wanted to have, you know, a more open-minded attitude toward the crypto industry, that Trump, and frankly, his campaign was able to communicate with those voters on that issue far more effectively than we were. And he embraced the crypto movement. And that's something that was going on and had been taking place, but was, I think, more of a movement toward younger men than maybe some of us realize on the campaign. But the bottom line is this, when it comes to younger men, we can't just look at people like voters like that and that voting block and say, oh, we're not going to worry about them. We're just going to put them off to the side. We're going to assume that they're going to be with, you know, the MAGA movement or whatever the Republican movement is in 2028. So we're just going to like figure out a new coalition, or we're going to try to get some of the voters who are typically part of our coalition, reliable coalition, who just sat out this election cycle for whatever reason. And we're just going to focus on getting them back. We really, as Democrats, especially on the presidential election, we cannot afford anymore to not try to fight for the voters who should be with us or with us before. I mean, sure, you may remember that climate, which is still a big issue at the ballot box, but climate was one of the defining issues of the 2024 election when it came to younger voters. And it was still a very important issue to younger voters this time around. But the crypto movement also crept in there more so than it certainly existed in 2020. So we got to figure out how to communicate with those voters, with all the voting blocks that we've continued to lose, you know, Latino men, Black men, working class voters across the board. We got to work on figuring out how to get them back into our fold. And a lot of that does come down to running very effective communicators who can go out to those voters and articulate the Democratic Party's vision and what we stand for and also be cool. You know, part of what we kind of lost among not every demographic, because Kamala Harris did incredibly well with a lot of different voters, voting sectors in this last election. But we got to be cool and edgy again. You know, I feel like I'm a cool person. I want to be a part of a party that is cool in the eyes of like-minded people like me. And I think we got to get the cool edge back in our party. The brand has been, you know, it was very cool under Obama. It was cool under Hillary, especially with women voters. We got to get that coolness back. And I think that we will do that with this next generation of candidates, many of whom will, I think, you know, run for president in 2028.
Yes. And I think that the Biden presidency is a great model for the future, whether you think about the CHIPS and Science Act, which you were very much a part of, when you think of the gun safety legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, the infrastructure bill. There's just so much. There are so many bills that you can talk about, that we could talk about, that were very successful. But just going forward, who do you think will emerge as the leader of the Democratic Party? Will one emerge in the next few months? Maybe it'll take up until midterms late next year. Is it somebody we're not talking about? When I interviewed Chuck Todd, Chuck was like, it may be somebody that we're not even talking about. And that's interesting too.
Yeah, no, Chuck is a good friend of mine, and he's exactly right. I mean, it could very well be someone. I mean, I can guarantee you around this time after Dukakis lost in 88, going into 89, which is essentially where we are right now without a de facto person that we know is for sure going to be the Democratic nominee. There are a lot of people out there thinking, oh, it might be Paul Tsongas. It might be Mondale or someone like, you know, we didn't know at that point. I mean, I was a very young child at that point, but I was very invested in the election. But But the bottom line is this, while Bill Clinton was kind of a little bit known on the national scene because of his incredible speech at the 88 convention that really put him on the map nationally, he was not the de facto, he's going to be our nominee. A lot of people were inspired by him. A lot of people were excited by him, just like a lot of people got excited about Barack Obama's speech at the convention in 2004. And they were hoping that he'd run in the future and that really put him on the map. But we didn't know for sure in 2004. In fact, we didn't think he'd be the nominee. We thought Hillary Clinton was going to be the nominee. You know, if Kerry lost, and Kerry, of course, was the nominee. So the bottom line is this. We do not have a single party leader right now. President Biden is still speaking out, which is good. President Clinton, Hillary Clinton, the Obamas, you know, but none of them are going to run for office again. They're not going to run for the presidency again. And while their voice is important, they all certainly recognize the importance of ushering in a next generation of leaders. Yeah. And I think instead of having one singular voice that is representing the direction of the Democratic Party, we're going to kind of be back to where we were in 89 when we had a bunch of people rising up and stepping forward. And 89 was kind of a messy year. But once we got, you know, closer to the midterms, once we actually had a successful midterm cycle, and then, of course, got closer to 1992, when, of course, Bill Clinton, you know, secured the nomination and then went on to win the presidency, we really did, you know, through him, and through the centrist movement, we were able to kind of get our footing back and figure out what we truly stood for as Democrats. And right now, we kind of got to figure it out with a bunch of different people and a bunch of different voices before we do that. I'll tell you, there are some really incredible people who, you know, are using their voice effectively. Pete Buttigieg, Rahm Emanuel, Alyssa Slotkin, I'm a huge fan of hers from Michigan. I don't think she's going to run for president in 2028, but she's very effectively able to communicate with working class voters, some of those voters in red states and rural areas that we have lost, unfortunately, that were with us in the 90s. And slowly but surely, we've lost through the years. So, you know, we have a number of effective messengers, and we just have to be able to lift up their voices and speak as a community and as a collective movement about what we stand for as Democrats. And that's not just running against Trump. That is articulating a vision, a forward-looking vision that can really inspire and get the American people excited.
Absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned the 89-90 period, and that really gave rise to President Clinton, because as Reagan in the 80s, we heard the terminology Reagan Democrats, but there were Clinton Republicans. I mean, he was able to balance the budget with Republican leadership. And, you know, you think about, okay, this transition now and what the future holds. Do you feel like there's a place for Kamala Harris to run again in 2028, or does she run to be the next governor of California? And what do you believe her role would be in the future in the Democratic Party?
We desperately need her voice out there, whether she runs for governor, whether she runs for the presidency, whatever she chooses to do, she is going to be somebody that has a very important voice and a very important place, not just in the Democratic Party, but in America as a whole. She's an incredibly effective speaker. She's inspiring. She's got a great track record. You know, she's held a number of elected offices. And I hope no matter whether she decides to run for governor of California or run for the presidency, whatever she decides to do, or be a private citizen and have a foundation and go out there and make an impact in a very meaningful way, you know, without running for office, which you can certainly do. All you have to do is look at the work the Clintons have done and the Obamas have done post administrations. You know, they've made such a significant impact on the world. And I think that she has a very strong place in no matter what she decides to do, and very important voice that should continue to be a part of the Democratic Party's movement.
Yes. And any final words about relationship building in a team environment before we depart from our interview? And I wanted to also say that I'm thinking and praying for President Biden and his family. I know with his recent cancer diagnosis that was publicly announced, I know that you're great friends with the Bidens, and we're all praying for him. And please send him my best.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. President Biden has certainly faced a number of odds in his life, a number of challenges. And I join you and probably a lot of people who are listening to this podcast in praying for him. And he certainly has access to great doctors and great healthcare. And we certainly wish him the best. I think relationships are everything. I mean, who you know is how you get some of the best jobs, not just in politics, but across multiple industries. You know, sitting on your couch and watching TV is something that we all need to do occasionally to unwind, but it's not going to, you know, when you're not out there, you know, among the people, you know, building those relationships, it's not something that is going to get you very far. So I encourage your listeners, especially the young people out there, you know, get on LinkedIn, reach out to people who you have common relationships with, you know, go to your alumni networks, whatever it may be. And it really get to know some folks, because people, I've certainly had people take me under their wing, which is how I got my start in politics. And I've certainly done the same for others. I love mentoring young people. especially people who are hard workers. And I can tell you that it's a gift that we get to be able to be mentors. And I think people out there should certainly take advantage and, you know, really focus on, you know, developing their own network of relationships and people that can pull them forward along the way.
Well, excellent words of wisdom and final thoughts on relationship building. I want to thank you again, Adrian, for being my 67th guest on the Wave Capital's guest speaker series on relationship building in a team environment. Loved our discussion, covered a lot of topics, and I really appreciate your time and look forward to many more conversations.
Thank you, Garrett. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day. You take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.